It's a couple of minutes after 8 o'clock on the Mornings with Ed show. Welcome to a Monday version of the program. Dr. Greg DiNicola, who's been on the show with us before, is the director of the Caduceus Medical Clinic. They've been involved in this fight since the very beginning. And after treating hundreds of COVID-19 patients, Dr. DiNicola contracted the virus himself. Well, he's back today to talk about the virus, its mutations, the vaccine, and his own personal battle with the virus. We welcome this morning to the program Dr. Greg DiNicola. Thank you for being here, Doctor.
Thanks, Ed. Happy to be here.
Okay, glad to have you. Now, let's get right into your personal recent battle with COVID. Can you walk us through it, where you might have contracted it, initial symptoms, and when you realized it was hospitalization bad?
I'm sure it was either started symptoms on December 13th, so probably the week before in seeing patients. I always wore my mask and I always try to stay 6 feet apart. But as we know, neither of those is 100%, as we had warned our patients. And I was seeing patients in the office face to face. And now, at the same time I got it, a couple of my nurses got it. Whether we got it from the same patient or I got it from her, I don't know.
Right.
I'm assuming it was the asymptomatic patient. You can only avoid the bullets for so many battles, right? I mean, I was very, very careful from March on, and eventually it's going to get you. And this was during that huge spike we saw in California where it was going through the roof, you know. So a lot of people had it asymptomatically. The odds were very great. I think it was Sunday the 13th I started to cough, but I wasn't worried because there was Santa Ana winds, and I cough in the winds all the time, so I blew it off.
Right.
But the next day, Monday, I had a fever and sneezed and coughed all day, and I knew that I probably had picked it up. So I arranged for a rapid test, and it was positive. So I stayed home, and for five days, I felt pretty good. I mean, I had a mild cough. No loss of taste or smell, no fatigue. I was around the house doing stuff. Everything seemed to be fine. But about 5 days later, I started coughing much worse. And then I got a high fever, chills, and I knew something bad was happening. I went to Amazon and ordered a pulse oximeter that you put on your finger and it tells you how your oxygen is.
Okay.
You want to be in the mid to high 90s normally. If it drops too far, it would imply, A, you have a bad pneumonia, and B, you'd be damaging your body. So I coughed all weekend. I really didn't get the oximeter until Monday, and my numbers were in the 80s, and I couldn't get them into the 90s, no matter what I did. I even had some oxygen at the office I went and tried. I mean, I had them bring it to my house and try it, and that didn't raise my numbers. I wasn't really feeling all that sick, but I couldn't stop coughing, and my oxygen numbers were really low.
And
so, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you about the oxygen itself. So using oxygen directly didn't help bring the oxygen levels up.
No. And I knew from my research, a bad COVID pneumonia needs high flow oxygen, which is, and I just had the normal oxygen you have in a doctor's office for somebody who's, not that bad. Low flow, which is the kind you see most people use, isn't effective against COVID pneumonia, or not as effective. So I knew I needed that. I probably needed remdesivir, which is IV. So keep in mind, I've never been in the hospital a day in my life. I've never been sick a day in my life, except a cold every year or two. So it was hard for me. And I'm Italian. We were chickens. Hard for me to listen to my wife and I was seeing my family. A
little hard-headed, are you?
Well, more fearful than hard-headed.
Okay.
But I had telehealth visit with my family doctor, and both he and my wife said, you're not doing well, and people are dying of this. You better go to the hospital. So,
right.
So I went to Hoga. I was admitted a couple days before Christmas. And my x-ray showed a pretty bad pneumonia. And my numbers even got down in the low 70s on the oxygen. So they started me on high-flow oxygen right away at 100%. And 100% is the highest you can have.
Right.
put me in the, it's called the SICU. It's the sub-ICU. It's not, you're not sick enough. ICU is usually for ventilators. You're not at that point, but you need close nursing care.
Right.
And it was pretty rough. It was. I was there 9 days, and it was a rough, at least five of them were really rough. The last four, I think, I was improving. Now, they did start me from Dysavir.
How long after you initially checked in did they start you on remdesivir?
The second hospital day. So the first day was just kind of settled in. That's where I write a blog. That's where I mentioned the blog when they brought out the IV bottle. It looked dark in glass, and usually they're clear vinyl.
Right.
And it looked exactly like a Kahlua bottle that was turned upside down.
So you were hallucinating.
Yes, shooting off of there were three devil faces. And I had to do a double take and look at it, so I assumed I was dreaming. That was my first thought.
Right.
But I didn't act like I was dreaming. I looked at my watch. It was the right time. You know, I squeezed my arm. I felt myself squeeze. So I looked a second time, and it was still there. So I didn't say anything to the nurse. I didn't look back up again that day. The next day, the nurse came back with my second dose.
Right.
And I asked her, was it a different IV bottle yesterday? She said, no, it's a clear vinyl bag. I said, was I asleep during the infusion? She goes, no, you were wide awake. We talked. I said, okay. So, yes, I was hallucinating. There were also a couple other hallucinations I won't get into, but I was definitely hallucinating.
Well,
high oxygen causes hallucinations and low oxygen can cause hallucinations, and I was on both.
Okay.
Since I've put that on my blog, I received hundreds of emails from people who had had COVID who also hallucinated with low oxygen. So, but usually we don't see that with most pneumonias. Like a typical pneumonia, we never see that. So something about COVID, it's a very aggressive, very mean virus. So I decided not to tell the nurse I was hallucinating because I wanted to get out of there eventually.
So as a doctor and as a scientist, observation is always the best research. What was it doing to your body?
The COVID or the...
The COVID. What was it doing to your body? How was it ravaging your body specifically?
Well, all it ravaged so far in me was my lungs. They had that ground glass appearance on the x-ray, and it caused a cytokine storm, which is something we've read about. It started a massive inflammatory reaction. When they checked my inflammatory markers, they were very high, meaning it wasn't a typical pneumonia you get from, like, community-acquired pneumonia where you get mucus and the mucus goes away. This was a case where it was pouring out mucus in my lungs. And you had to push the oxygen past it. And the remdesivir theoretically was supposed to kill the virus, although that's debatable. On the first day, my hopes were up. They had a specialist, an infectious disease doctor, say that there was a brand new drug approved by the FDA. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right because it just came out, excuse me, called baricitinib.
Okay.
It's anti-inflammatory. It had been used in like psoriasis and rheumatoid arthritis, those kind of diseases. But it had been FDA approved for COVID just a week before I was admitted. My wife called around just out of curiosity, and no other hospital had it, so my luck was in the right hospital. He said he had used it on six other patients. I was going to be the seventh, and all six improved with it. So I was pretty optimistic. But the next day, he came and said, I can't give it to you because your platelet count is too low. If it drops the platelet count too low, you can bleed.
Okay.
And I was devastated. I was just, like, so upset that...
The COVID itself was the reason for the platelet count being so low? Okay. Now...
Your whole body that way.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry, you go ahead.
Well, the second day he came in and said, your platelet count went up a little bit and you're sick enough, I want to give it to you. So he started that on my third day. He warned me it takes anywhere from 4 to 6 days to kick in. And sure enough, on my fourth hospital day, I definitely felt I was turning a corner, and they were able to start weaning me off the high flu O2.
Okay. Now, in a lot of circumstances, we're hearing about the virus being treated with monoclonal antibodies.
Yes.
That didn't...
I asked for that. I even begged for it. And the criteria are, like when Trump had it, you have to be within 40 to 72 hours of your first swab. And I was well past that, so I didn't meet the criteria. I also didn't meet the criteria for convalescent plasma, which is also given early as well.
Right.
So by the time I guess that's one lesson if anybody's listening and has COVID, is if you think your oxygen's lower, you think you're coughing a lot, go in right away and get checked, because a lot of the good treatments aren't available if you go too late.
Right. So if you'd have gone in that first 5-day period when you were just coughing and you were starting just coughing and hadn't received your thumb test kit yet, okay, they would have been able to give you that.
Although the first 5 days, I really felt pretty good. I assumed day 6 or 7, I'd be dancing the jig and out of it. But no such luck. The hardest part was, I knew, they told me, but I knew as a doctor, they couldn't start weaning me, and you can't go over 100% oxygen. That's the top you can go. Right. And they warned me you can only have a high flow oxygen probably a couple weeks, and then they have to stop it or change it. If it didn't work, they said I would might have to be transferred to the ICU. Wow. There's only one reason to transfer to the ICU, and that would be to intubate me, which I didn't want at all. So,
right.
And if intubation doesn't work, it's strike three. Then that's when people die. So I wanted to stay out of the ICU at all costs. So I knew my oxygen had to be in the mid 90s on the 100%. And no matter which way I laid or sat, it dropped unless I was on my right side flat. They tried saying, "We'll go back and forth so you don't get bed sores, go right, left," but every time I turned left, my numbers fell.
Right.
And every time I sat up, my numbers fell. Matter of fact, eating, I had to sit up, eat as fast as I could, because my numbers dropped immediately when I sat up, and even using a little urinal, my numbers dropped quickly. So almost 24/7, I had to lay on my right side flat, and the way the room is designed, I couldn't watch TV, I couldn't read, obviously. So for 200 hours, I was laying on my right side flat. The only thing I could see was the nurse's call button on the rails next to me. And of course, there's no visitors. So
Right. You're
much alone with your thoughts. I made a little game of it because I could turn my head and see my number on a screen. And if it was mid-90s, I would imagine the crowd cheering. And if it was 88, I'd imagine the crowd booing. And so they started to wean me on the third day, and they got me down to 80 and then to 70. But then when I hit a really depressing part, the nurse said, "Let's try 60. Now, to get me off of high flow, I got to get down to 30, and I know that. And being at 80 or 90, it seems so far away from 30. But so she put me to 60, and then a couple hours later, I said, "Are you going to go to 50? And she goes, "Well, no, I had to put you back to 70. I couldn't, 60 didn't work." I said, "Oh, no." And she goes, "Well, we'll try tomorrow. You never know." And I was just, I thought, they can't even get me to 60. How am I going to get to 30 in 2 weeks? You know, that's, I just saw myself up in the ICU being intubated. I was pretty worried. But the next day they got 50. And when that one drug kicked in, they could go from 50 to 40 to 30 pretty quickly. So the last couple of days, they were able to get me down to 40 and 30. Then they tried me on low flow O2 oxygen. And I held okay in the low 90s on that. And on day 9, they said, "Let's try sitting you up." And my numbers didn't fall when I sat up. And I said, "Can I watch TV? Can I read? Can I walk, you know, eat sitting up?" They said, "Well, yeah, but don't get too comfortable because we're going to send you home today."
We need the bed.
Yeah, you are worse than me. So I would have to go home, no question. But they hadn't even mentioned going home. That was even on the, not one doctor or nurse even said peep about going home. So that was kind of a shock. And that was New Year's Eve. So I rang in the new year on my couch, barely able to move. And for the first 3 weeks of January at home, it was really rough. I had to sleep on the couch because I couldn't go up the stairs to my bedroom. I couldn't shower. I had to get sponge bathed. I walk into the bathroom. I had people holding my hand.
This is...
They taught me exercises, but they totally wore me out. Meaning just walking down the hall was an exercise, and that just totally wore me out. I was on oxygen 24/7. Just changing my pajamas took so much energy.
My goodness.
But they had warned me when I left. They said it would be a month-to-month process, not to look at day-to-day or week-to-week. You know, measure yourself month-to-month. And they warned me. They said, this is going to be March or April before you really feel yourself.
Right. This coming Saturday will be just 2 months for you. So this Saturday is the 13th. That'll be 2 months since you initially feel you were infected.
And I see what they mean now, because in January I got discouraged because I said, I'm not any better today than yesterday. I'm not any better today than 3 days ago.
Right.
But I obviously got better because now I walk up the stairs to my bedroom. I'm off oxygen except at night when I sleep. They have me walking. I live in a cul-de-sac. So they tell me to circle the cul-de-sac 3 times a day, which I now can do easily where I couldn't do it before. So I know I'm a lot better in February than January.
Right.
I couldn't have even done it in January. I would have been out of breath after a minute. So I think if they're right, March will be better than February, and maybe April will be myself. But that's how terrible this virus is. It's
insidious.
Then when I left the hospital, my clotting studies were normal. Remember, COVID can make your blood hyper thick. And that's why there's so many cases of strokes and heart attacks, people with COVID. And the worst part is you can get a clot in your leg, and that can cause an embolus to your lungs with instant death. So when I left, I said, do I get a blood thinner to go home with? Because I don't want to get that. And they said, no, your clotting studies are normal, so you don't need it. But my research, I knew that COVID will hit your clotting delayed, like even a month after you get it. So I had a lab come out and draw me, and sure enough, my clotting studies were elevated a couple weeks ago. So I was seeing my doctor on telehealth, and he put me on blood thinners. So, but that's how, again, how bad this virus is. You think you're over it,
right?
And it can hit you in so many ways. But a couple weeks ago, I tested negative with the swab, and I did an antibody count, and they were through the roof, meaning I'm pretty immune. So those are all good signs.
Wow. Well, an absolutely frighteningly honest depiction of what happened to you. Do you think that this makes you better able to treat it now? Do you think your personal experience will make it better, make you better able to treat it?
Ironically, though, when I was laying there, I said to myself, you know, if this is kind of like a warning shot from the guy upstairs, you know, statistically, I probably, by insurance tables, have 20 years left. I don't know, maybe more. My parents lived in the 90s, so I'm probably in good shape. I'm not diabetic. I have no lung disease. That's what shocked me so much. I've just been extremely healthy my whole life, and you know, no illness whatsoever.
Right.
But I thought if this could happen again, how do I want to spend the next 20 years? And so right now I'm on a sabbatical from seeing. I couldn't see them if I wanted to, but in April when I'm better, I'm not sure if and when I'll go back and see patients.
Okay.
But I'm still medical director, and I oversee the COVID team. So I am kind of treating them indirectly.
Okay.
And yes, it's totally changed. Ironically, just in the past month, we had to send a dozen or more, maybe 20 patients to the various hospitals for the same exact thing I had. And we were able to warn them what to expect. So yes, it did improve that.
Right.
On the other hand, you're kind of like fighting a opponent. You really... It's not like a sport thing where you can scout them out ahead of time and know how to do it. They're playing by their own rules, COVID, and they can attack you so many ways. And if it could put somebody like me into the hospital and close to intubation, right. It could do it to anybody.
It has, yeah. So, and now, we have variants that are finding sneakier ways to get us. So I'd like to go over a little bit of what we know and what we don't know about the variants and the mutations. And we do know it's more contagious because it's more efficient in attaching to our protein spikes. So as it mutates in maybe a year or two from now, you think it'll eventually fit perfectly like a puzzle piece on our receptors and we'll be unable to fight it with vaccine?
That's the nightmare you're going through at Mayo Clinic and UCLA and all that. The odds are against it, but that's certainly a theoretical possibility. But again, we've been kind of learning as we go on this. So if that happens, maybe we'll be better at treating it, like with an antiviral.
Right.
Because that's what they're working on now, are antivirals, similar to how Tamiflu kills the influenza virus. You know, we talk about the flu vaccine, but we forget there's an antibiotic for the flu as well.
Right.
We don't have that for this. So if what you're saying, if a doomsday thing like you're saying happened, maybe in the laboratories at Mayo Clinic, they'll be developing antivirals against it, which would be good.
Okay. We had mentioned, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, nothing. Cool.
Okay. I was going to suggest that earlier we had mentioned monoclonal antibodies as a way to fight it in those first few days. But do you think, like, eventually, you also mentioned antibiotics, eventually, like antibiotics are becoming more resistant to bacteria, will the virus mutate into something resistant to monoclonal antibodies?
Yes, but they can always change them. It's kind of like, in basketball, you change your strategy depending on how they're hitting the shots. So right. If they were to mutate away from that, they would just make another antibiotic. But Tamiflu has been working for the flu for 10, 20 years. And the flu hasn't really, it mutates, but it still responds to Tamiflu. So
right.
Either this is going to burn itself out. If you do some history lesson, the 1918 Spanish flu that we know so much about, was an H1N1 virus, which is actually an influenza virus. But it just burned itself out. It just disappeared. It came back. You might say, wait a minute, H1N1, we had that a few years ago. Yeah, it actually reappeared after 80 years, but it did disappear back in the 1920s. So when you mention mutations, people forget viruses, unlike bacteria and other organisms, mutate constantly. I mean, really. And most of the time, the mutations are for the detriment of the organism. They rarely improve. In this case, though, the strains I'll talk about if you want soon, the UK strain, South Africa strain, those mutations actually strengthened the coronavirus. But typically, for example, in humans, we mutate, and cystic fibrosis and sickle cell anemia are both mutations that happened as we evolved. And they weaken us. They're bad for us. So most mutations, that's probably what happened with the Spanish flu of 1918, H1N1 mutated, and died out. The COVID is not, it's mutating, but it's not getting weaker. It's getting stronger, unfortunately.
Right. We're finding that the British mutation is possibly up to 30% stronger, 30% more. Right.
Yeah. I had to research this when I got home because I wasn't able to read in the hospital, but the UK only started in December. It has a much higher penetrance, meaning how easy is it to catch, and it has a higher fatality rate. Now, they haven't done enough studies to know exactly how aggressive it is, but the UK variant is stronger, meaner, more aggressive. And if COVID keeps mutating like that, we're far from over this. Now, so far, the good news is, except for one of the vaccines, the UK variant appears to be stopped by the vaccine. At least that's what original studies are showing.
Okay.
And the South African variety is very similar. It's a different code number. When they do the genome, it's a different genome. But it also is equally fatal, spreads easier, more aggressive, higher hospitalization rate. And then the Brazil one, when he started in January, which that's when they first found it, and they found it, ironically, on airport screening. it's also very bad. And unfortunately, that one appears to circumvent all the current vaccines,
right,
which is a nightmare. So all these three new mutations are more virulent, higher hospitalization rate, higher complications, higher death rate. So I unfortunately don't have good news in the mutation arena.
Right. And let me ask you this. I've been getting questions since our listeners found out you were going to come on the program. More parents have been asking me that, understanding the desire to open schools, a lot of cities are revisiting the in-person learning now, exposing kids as hosts that weren't exposed before. And since kids aren't figuring in the early vaccinations, is it possible we could see a mutation of the virus that is targeting new hosts and these kids?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Okay. Looking back, because we have a pediatric practice and actually have a pediatrician on our COVID team, so we're always researching kids. At first, kids weren't getting it at all. Then kids got it, but it was a milder case. Then kids got it. The death rate was very low compared to adults. But every time we look, it's more aggressive. It's hitting more kids, more serious cases, more hospitalizations. Again, the mutations haven't been kind to the pediatric form of this. And you're absolutely right, because they're not getting vaccines. When schools reopen, they'll be elbow to elbow. And you know, how do you take a bunch of third graders with masks and make sure they don't interact? It's impossible.
Right. Right. So that's going to be a concern now. And as I see, I see us kind of moving into that dangerous zone. I kind of see us right now in the eye of a hurricane. And yeah, the hospitalization and ICU rates, and certainly here in Orange County, are dropping. But I see that as kind of the eye of the storm, especially with the new variants out.
Yes. Now, the numbers are falling in California. We've got mutations. I don't know if you're going to ask me about it, but you know, there's the West Coast mutation.
Yes, yes. Please tell us about the California or the West Coast mutation.
It's distinct from the three I just mentioned. Genome. They thought at first it was just the UK variant. For example, they thought they had their own mutations in Ohio and Illinois, but when they genomed it, it was the same as the UK. So the UK one just simply got to Chicago and Cleveland.
Okay.
But our West Coast mutation, which is mostly California, it's a little bit up north, is distinct from those three mutations. The problem is they're thinking now it probably is more vaccine resistant. Not 100% where the vaccine won't work at all, but if you read the vaccine is 80% effective or whatever against COVID, it might only be 50% effective against the West Coast. So that's the first bad news. Second, it's spreading so fast, and so now they're thinking that's why in mid to late December, like when I got it, the numbers are going through the roof. They had tried blaming Thanksgiving, which maybe was part of it, but California was ground zero for deaths and hospitalizations from mid-December till mid to late January, and that corresponds exactly when the West Coast mutation occurred. It's actually three mutations that happened in the same genome, so it's a totally different type of COVID than the kind we saw in the fall and spring. When they went back and looked, and Cedars and UCLA have been leaders in researching this, and they took serum from patients in October, 0% had the West Coast genome. In November, 4% had the West Coast genome. In December, 25 to 40% had the West Coast genome. So it's kind of taking over. It's been identified in L.A., San Diego, Orange County, San Francisco, and the Central Coast. So it's up and down our whole coast. And I'm thinking probably that's what I have, because the West Coast variant is very easy to spread.
Right.
And I got it protected. And it causes a much higher hospitalization and fatality rate. It causes a very serious pneumonia. And for the usual COVID virus, I'm not diabetic. I have no lung disease. I shouldn't have really gotten as sick as I did.
Right.
I'm thinking, I don't know for sure, but I got it in mid-December when the West Coast variant really started to bloom. So if you have family members who got very, very ill in mid to late December, there's a good chance they had this variant.
Right. So So what we're looking at really is a race between getting more vaccinations in the arms of Southern Californians or Californians in general and this variant that appears that it's going to be the most prevalent form of the virus.
Yeah. And the only silver lining in all this is that the numbers have fallen. For example, last week I called the floor I was on at Hoag. The nurses were so great there. And the nurses were in charge of the wing, not the doctors and not the respiratory therapists. The nurses would come in and say, okay, we're going to get you down to 50. Let's do it, you know, like a cheerleader. And if I said, can I do 40 after that? They go, no, no, let's not go too fast. But they were 100% in charge of the wing. And they did such a great job, and they were so positive the whole time. Even when things weren't going well, they were very positive. So I wanted to send them a Fruit of the Month Club or something just to thank them. Mm-hmm. So I called over to find out who to send it to and all that. And I said, so how busy you are? She goes, we currently have no COVID cases here at all. Wow. I said, none? She goes, we were full till mid-January, and now that most of them are in the not... I was in the sub-ICU, they said. She said all the admissions now are going to the normal floor, and they're much easier to wean, and the high flow oxygen we don't even start at 100% anymore; they start lower. So it sounds like there might be a lull right now. I don't know, because that's only one hospital, so you can't.
Okay, so. Let's hope I'm wrong about the eye of the storm, and that it is a lull that continues. With that said, and vaccines and the rollouts having stumbled. Back in December and January, more vaccines are getting into arms right now. What would you think about what the discussion is now with single doses of vaccine, of the two-dose vaccine, and then maybe delaying the second dose until we get more people with shots? Is there a danger to missing the timing on that second dose in your eyes?
I don't believe there is. And in the past couple of weeks, 80% of my reading has been to the vaccines because they just don't know. There's anybody who claims to be a vaccine expert, they're lying. There is no, because they had to rush these out, and I'm glad they rushed them out. I mean, we want people vaccinated, but we just don't have the track record here. They didn't have enough time in the laboratory to track them. So I think I'm very popular among patients who want a populist opinion. I'm not very popular with doctors, scientists, because I'm not sure you even should take the vaccine right now if you have antibodies. Before I got sick in December, the wisdom was if you've had COVID, who cares? You still need the vaccine. Right. But we've seen so many reactions, serious reactions with people who have already had antibodies, meaning like me, my antibodies are through the roof. Technically, I'm supposed to get the vaccine, but I'm not sure I want the vaccine right now. Right. I have Mother Nature's antibodies, which should work. Right. And
I think the question there is for how long, though?
I know that I'm going to end with some recommendations on that. Mm-hmm. But so you can check your antibodies. So people who had the first vaccine, the first shot, if they get their second shot and they already have a lot of antibodies from the first shot, you see much more reactions. Now, you need the second shot. That this is a miscommunication that if you don't get both shots, you're not going to be protected. That's not what I read. It seems like one shot might give you 50% and two shots 90%.
Right.
So, I mean, you should satisfy the 50, but it isn't like it doesn't help at all.
Right. Well, 50%, I guess, was the minimum standard for CDC. It was the low bar in this when the CDC said that the FDA said that they would approve 50 was the minimum.
So I'm pretty excited about the Johnson & Johnson. And if I do need to get a vaccine, I will probably try to take that. Although it's only 72% compared to 90% for the others, it's one shot.
Right.
Which is much better. Matter of fact, if you make a million doses of Moderna, it only helps 500,000 people. But a million doses of Johnson & Johnson helps a million people. So you can't do that. The good news, unlike even AstraZeneca, unlike Moderna and Pfizer, the Johnson & Johnson has been shown to be 85% effective preventing moderate to severe disease. By definition, you go in the hospital, it's severe, so I had severe disease. But if you're home, in bed, feeling really sick with fevers, and that's moderate. Mild is just a, you know, easy thing.
Right. Now, will Caduceus be receiving doses?
Boy, you know, we put our order back in December. Our supplier says, not yet, not yet, not yet. And unless somebody has a black market or bribing, no normal doctor has them. I mean, you know, you just don't walk into a doctor's office and get one like the flu shot.
Right.
The distribution has been very suspect. The way it worked is the FDA has to approve it. So they did their job. Then by law, it goes to the CDC, and the CDC does the distribution criteria, but those are recommendations, not law. So when you hear about healthcare workers and nursing home people and sick seniors, that all came from the CDC. Then they gave them to the states, and once they're in the state's hands, every state can do what they want, really.
Right.
There's been very surveillance. So when you hear about a healthy 50-year-old who somehow wangled it somewhere, that totally was against what the CDC wanted.
Right.
I had a very emotional email from a patient a couple of days ago. He's a school teacher, but he does have a lot of underlying medical conditions. And he was begging me to help him get the vaccine because he didn't meet the criterion. Everywhere he called, denied him. I said, I don't know what I can do. You know, I mean, short of finding a Beverly Hills doctor and paying him $1,000, I don't know. I don't know how to get you a vaccine. So distribution has been very suspect. Hopefully, once AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson come out and flood the marketplace,
right,
we'll get our order. They kept telling us March or April, so if they're right, we will have it by then.
Okay, and you would be looking for either AstraZeneca or the Johnson & Johnson. Is Caduceus set up for the Pfizer vaccine? Do you have those kind of freezers?
I don't think we do. That's the other thing is Johnson & Johnson to be refrigerated. So, and the other amazing thing is that there was a 85% protection against hospitalization and 100% protection against death with Johnson & Johnson. So you may have a higher chance of getting it, but you won't end up in the hospital or intubated like I was.
Right.
So I'm very excited about the Johnson & Johnson one. I did tell patients way back in December who were saying, put me top of the list, doc, you know, I said, personally, I'm going to wait 60 or 90. This is before I got it, COVID. I said, I'm going to wait 60 or 90 days because I don't know what's going to happen with these things. You know, I don't know what side effects are going to happen and which one's better than the other one. And so they looked at me like I was crazy. Like, you'd wait 60 or 90 days? I said, yeah, I would. And I think even today, if I didn't have antibodies, I would probably at least wait till March or April before I took the vaccine. Yeah. That's just me. I know that high-risk people, nursing home, you know, right, they certainly need it.
Right. I'm not, I'll be honest with you. I'm not even a high, I'm not high risk, but I would get the vaccine as soon as it was available to me. As soon as I put myself on, you know, I signed up for it and I'm getting close to being of age for it. But I put myself on the list and I thought, yeah, you know, I'm ready. As soon as it comes out, I just want, there's a certain feeling of security there. And I having heard your story of what you suffered through, I think, nah, I don't want to do that, man. I don't want to go through that.
Totally agree. Totally.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
My last thing, I mean, you can ask anything you want, but what I'm recommending to our patients is, and I actually started this in December before I got ill, there's three ways to get antibodies. And antibodies do work. I don't know who ever put the word out that antibodies don't work against COVID. They do work. And the studies after study after study. If you don't have antibodies, you're very, very high risk. If you have antibodies, and you can measure how many antibodies you have if you want to pay for that test.
Right.
The more antibodies you have, the more protected you are. It just makes sense. If somebody threatened your house that they were going to rob it, you know, if you could afford to put 10 policemen outside, you're protected. 100, you're more protected. 0, you're not protected at all. That's exactly how antibodies work. They intercept the virus and deactivate it. So you want antibodies. There's three ways to get it. Convalescent plasma, which is hard to find and expensive, but some people did manage to get it. Having had COVID, like me, that's where my antibodies came from. Or the vaccine, like you. Even your vaccine, you'll get antibodies.
Right.
We don't know on all three of those how long they left. And the hypothetical that the scientists said in November, December is, well, the vaccine will last to longer than the natural antibody. But we don't know that at all. So let's say you took a vaccine today and you got a bunch of antibodies, and I checked myself and I got a bunch of antibodies, but mine came from having COVID. Yours came from the vaccine. And we checked both ourselves in September. We don't know which, like, you might have them and I lost mine, vice versa. We don't know. Right. There's just nothing there. So most insurances cover it. If they don't, we charge $60 for the antibody test. I don't think that's out of line. I'm suggesting all of our patients have a monthly antibody test in January. From January to December this year.
Right.
If they either had COVID or had the vaccine. Now, if they haven't had COVID, I guess that wouldn't be necessary. But
right.
I'm going to check myself monthly because I don't know when mine are going to disappear.
Right.
My two of my sons got vaccinated because they're in healthcare, and they're going to get checked monthly because they don't know when theirs going to disappear. So that's my advice, is to check your antibodies regularly if you have them. Because that would mean a booster shot, theoretically, if you lost your antibody.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that. And I'm going to ask you kind of a theoretical question here. This is just a question if we're just chilling out on the couch and I turn to you and ask you, because of the introduction of this virus into our society, do you think that overall life expectancy is going to decrease substantially down the road? Where do you see us in 5 years?
I hope not, but you're right. This post-COVID syndrome has a lot of life-shortening components to it. So theoretically, it could. I don't think it did in 1918. I don't think that shortened life expectancy. I'd have to research it. But I'm hoping that this does burn itself out. I mean, again, the other ones did. SARS-1, beginning of this century, burned itself out, and that was a coronavirus. So, but yeah, it could. I would pray it doesn't, but it could.
All right. Dr. DiNicola, I would love for you to check back in with us every once in a while and let us know, first of all, how you're doing and how your research is going. I understand that this is your first interview since you got sick and you had a lot of choices to share your story. I want to thank you for sharing it with us and sharing this information with us.
Happy to do it, Ed.
Always a pleasure. Dr. Greg DiNicola, Caduceus Medical Clinic. He's the director, and the very best of luck and health to you, sir.
Thanks, Ed.
Have a great rest of the day. Thank you, Dr. DiNicola. It's the Mornings with Ed Show, 8:45 the time.